Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, founders, clinicians and this week journalists that are leading the UK's healthcare revolution and leading the healthcare revolution outside of the UK. As regular listeners will know, I am a CEO and founder myself of a business called PocDoc. PocDoc's mission is to identify, to screen, and to risk assess and provide treatment or to direct people into treatment for cardiovascular disease, metabolic and chronic kidney disease. We're working extensively with the NHS across the country, and we're also available in community pharmacy. If anyone would like to learn more about PocDoc, please go to pocdoc.co. So that's pocdoc.co. And thank you very much to PocDoc for supporting the show. As ever, at the top of the show, I always say thank you. Thank you to UK Health Radio for providing us with the live platform. If you're new to UK Health Radio, or even if you've been listening for a while, there are tons of great presenters across the station, tons of great content. So I'd recommend you have a look at some other shows. Obviously, you can just listen to my show, but there are other shows available. Thank you to everyone that's listening live. Thank you to everyone that's listening on demand, whether that's on Spotify, on Apple, or on your podcast channel of choice. And finally, thank you if you're watching on YouTube or on my Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost, where we take some clips and we put the best clips out on my Instagram. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. I love doing the show. You know, Christmas was great, but it's great to be back, back in the hot seat, back doing the show. And actually, this being the first week back, we've got a new type of guest on. So we've never had a journalist on the show before. And it's an absolute pleasure to have such an eminent journalist in the health and lifestyle space on as Liz Hoggard, who's one of the leading healthcare and wellness journalists in the UK, writes for The Telegraph. And Liz describes herself or her articles as being potentially sounding slightly bonkers in the name of health journalism, including things like eating a 1970s diet and thinking like a man to control stress. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that we can get into on the show. But Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Good. So let's jump into it. I would love to know, what got you into journalism and health and care, healthcare, health, wellness, journalism as a subset of that? Like, what's that journey?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've been a print journalist for a long time, probably too long. And in the past, I mostly did sort of arts and lifestyle and women's issues. But I would do big health interviews if there was a celebrity or an interesting author who had a health issue that they'd been through or their book was about their health journey. So I did quite a lot of that, but I hadn't particularly seen myself as a health journalist. And then the market's changing quite a lot. There's a lot more interest in digital first now on newspapers, less arts coverage. And I did, I think, a piece about 3 years ago for The Telegraph about my cataract journey.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very glad. Okay. And I had it done quite early because I had, you know, very poor sight. Plus, I had an invisible squint, which I think these days would be picked up much earlier for kids. So they were a bit worried about how that was all going to go. And so I wrote about it and they were keen, I think. I mean, with all these stories, yes, it's you banging on about yourself, but really what matters is opening it out to the readers and in a sense, encouraging readers that it wasn't such a scary op and that they could do it too.
And did you feel like at the time no one was really writing like that? Or were there other people writing like that?
I think probably there's this new hybrid, which is sort of half lifestyle, half health. So I know what I'm like. If I'm reading a really dense article, and of course, it's very important to cite scientific papers and to be accurate and quote experts, but you can zzz a bit. And I realized that if I was reading a piece by a journalist I'd liked or admired or found very funny over the years, and then they told me something really serious, like they were having treatment for cancer or they had gone through something else, what led me to take note and to read it properly was a bit of colour, personal anecdote, and that you can draw people in. And also, we're all so much more interested than we were. I mean, I grew up in a generation where you went to the dentist once a year and you were making a fuss if you ever talked about having skin problems, or it was all dismissed. So it's very different for young people now.
And do you feel like the move into or the digitization of print journalism has fueled this or is connected to this, or are they slightly separate trends just running concurrently?
No, I think they are. And what's interesting is most newspapers now are what they call digital first. So you will probably find an article goes up quite fast, but may not turn up in the papers for weeks or may not turn up at all.
Oh, it can be weeks, can it?
It can months
Really?
sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. And do they make a decision using like traffic data about whether it goes into the paper? Or like, for example, it didn't get much visibility on the website, so it just doesn't go in the paper. Or how do they
Yes,
do
I
it?
mean, I'm not quite sure how they decide it, but increasingly, I mean, there was a story this week that Daily Mirror journalists are going to be, they can tell now when readers are reading our pieces online, when they get bored, how far they get down the paragraphs. It can be
Really?
fine. And also, I guess if they're giving something a different chance, they can redo it. Often it's about visuals. I mean, a great visual. I mean, we owe so much to the photographers that work with us because they
Right.
can rescue a piece that's looking a bit dull with just a very arresting picture. But yes, there's definitely a sense now that if we don't get the hits, we're not doing very
You
well.
know what? Do you know what's interesting about that? And I'm not an expert in this, but it's like you're because there's an element with some journalism and some titles where I think you opt in to hear the opinion and the way that that person wants to write that thing. Whereas if what you'll end up doing is optimizing based on what the algorithm thinks people want to read, is not really the same thing. Do you see
Yeah.
what I'm trying to get to? Does that make any
No,
sense?
sure of that. And obviously, we've all learned to read newspapers and magazines on iPads.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get just the normal flow that you'd get if you were turning the pages. Other times you're clicking onto links and what looks like a really big story might only be a five liner. So
Right.
it's an interesting way of representing news. And health, I think what's very interesting for papers like the Telegraph and the Times is they are really doing so much more of it because it gets so many hits. We're the worried well in lots of ways, and there's
Right.
serious problems going on as well.
And what do you have you noticed any like uptick as these sort of maybe the NHS has got more resource constrained and maybe it's or maybe it was connected to COVID, I don't know, like an uptick in people being interested in all kinds of different health articles, health journalism?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did a piece about cholesterol recently,
Yeah,
trying to
it's
keep
on my
down
list,
actually.
don't worry.
And so many people contacted me and said, "Oh my God, I've been really worrying about it," or "I've had a high reading," or, and I sort of thought, "Oh God, is anyone going to be interested in this? Is it just my own personal journey?" And so it was,
Yeah.
you never know which one's going to resonate with readers or what they're going through.
So let's talk about that cholesterol article because that was what prompted me to reach out to you via our producer to see if we can get you on the show. Because our company PopDoc is all in and around the cardiovascular disease screening space, cholesterol screening, trying to do it more affordably, massively upscale it. Because the cardiovascular disease, as you probably know, is like the one of the biggest, if not the biggest, single cost center for the NHS. But it's largely preventable, either through treatment, which is not what you did, but also through healthy living, lifestyle, diet, all those different things. So it represents this amazing opportunity to save a huge amount of money for the system. But you've got to kind of go out and do this population health level thing. So I'm really excited about the article. So maybe could you just give us a bit of a summary of it and then we can dive into bits and bobs.
Well, I've originally gone to have, that annual health check, which is another thing I think so many people don't realise, that you're eligible between 40 and 75 to be sent to have, to have an ECG, have your blood test, check if you're pre-diabetic. So I went along to have that partly because everybody in my family, bless, has died of heart disease or a heart attack.
Okay.
And I am what they call within the risk factor because my had a grandfather died before the age of 45 and my
You
dad had
got
first heart
close.
attack at 60. So they're always on at you to be a bit cautious about those things. Actually came through all of that fine, to my surprise,
Okay.
but the cholesterol, and I was at a point from being pre-diabetic and my cholesterol was high. And
Okay.
I eat a pescatarian diet and do quite a lot of exercise, but clearly wasn't
Okay.
eating the right things. So the choice at my age, because I'm 62 this year, is whether you go on statins or not, and
Yeah.
have populations on it and have a good experience. But I have some friends who had really tricky experience with them, and I
Okay.
thought quite like to see if I can bring it down naturally first.
Okay. And what was that interaction like when, so I'm hugely interested in this because Poc Doc's being used quite widely to deliver health checks, both in GP surgeries and in communities, pharmacies, homes, to try and increase access. So one of the issues around the health check, which you sort of alluded to, is people don't know, people are busy, they don't want to take time off, they can't get an appointment, they won't go in. There's all kinds of different issues around that. And so we've been really working about how do you increase those rates. And what, so what was the discussion like with your, I guess, a GP, or was it a healthcare advisor around the treatment or not treatment? Like, was it sort of, did they think you were crazy when you said, no, I'm not for me, or how did that kind of shake out?
It was a follow-up phone call, which obviously is never quite as personal as, but I found the doctor very kind and helpful. And I said, look, I'd like to have a go. I'd like to take the next 6 months to see if I can bring it down. If I end up going on statins, then I do. And he said, well, with your, actually, I think I also wasn't quite eligible because I was under what they call the QR risk, which is
Key
where they
risk.
all your health factors. And I was still under 10, so technically
Oh,
not
interesting.
for statins, but
Interesting.
it bumped me up the list because of my family history.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, can I have a go at trying to bring it down naturally? And then we'll make a decision in 6 months' time or whatever.
So that's super interesting. I love that you know all the terms. So Key risk is
Immediately.
yeah, Key risk is so our app calculates Key risk in real time, and yeah, it's that 10% marker, but they can, as you alluded to, they have also clinical discretion. So
Yeah.
Q risk for there's an argument, would you believe, a clinical argument going on at the moment about lowering the age that you qualify for the health check from 40 to 30, because there are so many people that are unhealthy in their 30s
Yeah.
that it would make sense. But a lot of the people in their 30s wouldn't have a 10% Q risk necessarily, because of the age is quite an important factor in the calculation. And so how do you, without wishing to give away your exact stats, how much did you need to bring it down by, either as a percent, like what did you want to get down, like what was the drop that you were looking to do?
Well, I yes, I'm probably a bit ashamed that it was as high as it was, but actually, I've heard of people who are much higher. So now I'm all out and proud. So I was 6.7, and
Okay.
really, your total serum cholesterol, which is all the stats within it, should be 5.
Yes.
So I brought it down. I did a big exercise thing and started swimming 3 times a week and going to the gym, which I've never done before because I just find
Okay.
that whole slightly male clubbable ethos very hard. Of course, gyms have
Yeah.
changed a lot since then. And I went one to one where you wear a heart rate monitor, so that was
Oh,
incredibly.
cool.
Orange Theory, who I owe everything to, all the young people were very patient with tech phobic me. But then when I went back, it had gone down. It had gone down to 6.1, I
Oh,
think,
nice.
but obviously still not 5. So then I thought, oh, I do have to do something about what I'm eating. Finally, I mean, I thought I was eating fairly healthily, but I was beginning to realise I just wasn't
Oh,
in
okay.
terms.
Okay.
Or I was eating a lot of ultra processed foods or just, too much carbs, basically. My joy in life
Okay.
was baked potato. Every freelancer sits at home and puts the microwave on.
What's interesting about that is, so we in our experience, have been doing this cross country, that it's really not unusual in certain areas to see significant volumes of people with over 7.5 or higher.
Oh.
We've seen like significant percentages of people that might have a Q risk of 15% or higher. So
Yeah. Wow.
it's a major issue across the country. So it's great that you got it down to 6.1. That's amazing. And did you feel like what was the kind of, when you were writing the article, when you write these articles, are you writing them, or how much are you writing them with, because you're not necessarily advising people. I've read them. It's not like you're not a guru. You're not saying this is what you should do. It's very much just sharing what you have done and your experiences, isn't it?
Yes, totally. And actually, the first time when I did just the exercise, well, the exercise was my main focus. I got it down to 6.1, but then through diet, I got it down to 5.7. And I was still having a glass of red wine and occasional pizza. I'd gone through a breakup and had not, gone off the wagon for it. So I suspect I've got inherited high cholesterol, like a lot of people have. So it's no one's fault. But I think it's really interesting to try. If I have to go on statins, because obviously you get older, as you say, your risk goes up. I probably will have to, but let's try not to. But yeah, what I feel is quite important about being a sort of every woman gonzo journalist or whatever is you get.
I'd written down the word gonzo on my thing. I didn't know whether that was acceptable to
Obviously,
use.
yes.
Yeah, I'd written that down.
I don't think I quite match his tactics of how to do it all. But what I think is really a luxury is to be able to go and talk to experts or, increasingly we do it on Zoom and all the rest of it. But early on, when in my career, I met some really important female health professionals, including Marion Gluck, the extraordinary
Okay.
female hormone doctor who pioneered bioidentical hormones, and also Yves Lom, the great sort of skin guru. So they taught me things just as a friend. And I thought, if I can share this is really important. And so you're not claiming to be a great expert. You're an expert on you, but not much else. But hopefully, at the end of your week or 2 weeks of research, you'll have learned a lot.
And is it so? I sort of, it kind of relates to how I feel about this show, actually, which is this is, I think, the number 112. I think this will be 112, 113. And we've had all kinds of people on. And is it, I'm not the expert. But I can hold a conversation, and I can have a discussion, and I can unearth things that I think would be really interesting for different people. So, the last few shows that we've done have been all with women from different aspects, m a lot from reproductive health, menopause, and like there's a lot of male journalists and male sort of, I don't know what you would call me in this setting, content people, I don't know, that wouldn't necessarily interact with that. It's like, well, I'm just having a conversation and asking questions. It's sort of a similar thing, So you don't have to be the expert.
No, and I listened to a couple of them. Dr. Hazel that you
Yeah,
had.
Dr. Hazel Wallace.
And I was so impressed that you talked in a very grown-up way about issues about the female body. And we all had, the very fact that we weren't even allowed to have sort of tampon adverts on television. Even I didn't know that. And it's really important that we can all be a bit more sensible about it.
That blew me away. But I remember as a kid with like the blue water, and
Yeah.
now like they did with the nappies, and now it all sort of like it all kind of makes sense. So what was the you kind of hinted at it. What was the actual reaction to that cholesterol story? Were you surprised about it? Are you surprised when you do these articles and it goes well, and people are like, oh my gosh, I'm so interested in this?
That one I was less surprised about because a writer colleague, Miranda Levy, who's also a brilliant health journalist, she wrote a piece about should she go on statins. So she did all the heavy lifting, the serious medical analysis, and they got an extraordinary response to it. So I think they
Really?
knew. And so when I said I'd like to have a go at doing it naturally, they were like, okay, yes. So I think so they were fairly aware that it was going to have a big post bag for good and for bad, because of course, if
Oh.
you're on statins, why would you want this upstart going, I'm trying to avoid them? So
Well,
you
I mean,
get quite a broad response.
Well, I think what's interesting is like the lifestyle advice applies whether you're on statins or not on statins. Dietary advice, it applies across the board. So it doesn't necessarily harm anybody, to be eating more healthily. I think my own experience with this, so one of the reasons I feel so passionately about the company is my dad had a huge stroke when I was 14 due to undiagnosed cardiovascular disease. So in a similar, not exactly, it's not the same family history as yours at all, but the same thing around testing and stuff like that. And so at the beginning of last year, obviously as a founder, everything's going 100 miles an hour, and how much time can you take for yourself? My cholesterol was somewhere in the region of between 5.9 and 6.2, somewhere in that range. And so I quit alcohol, caffeine, red meat and cheese. And within 3 months, it had dropped by like 1.5 points.
Yeah. It's really empowering when you find, I mean, I might hit a sort of plateau now, but it did really cheer me up and make me keep going when I didn't feel like it, you know.
Well, so this is exactly why we developed the company that we developed, right? Because we realized that if you wouldn't it be great if you could just test yourself at some point and work out that it was working? And it sounds like you've got, because not everybody can go back to the doctors and keep getting those tests done. So imagine if you just had a test in the cupboard and you could pull it out and you could be like, oh wow, I've gone down. That's kind of where we sort of came up with it, because it's that feedback loop, like you say, that's so critical.
Yes, I mean, I've got a blood pressure monitor, and that's so helpful to keep an eye on. But when I suddenly, you know, because they sort of say, right, try, keep going on the cholesterol piece, not ready for it yet. And then there was a like, we need it tomorrow. And I was trying somebody who would do me a cholesterol test overnight, and a well-known pharmacy brand was the only one in the end, because I just couldn't get one, you know, even paying. So that would be very helpful, I think.
We're in Well Pharmacy, Asda, Boots, that type of thing. Oh, we're not in Boots yet, but you know, there's the we can dream. But the yeah, it's really, I think that's really important. We have to go for, oh look, your cat's awake, for those people that will be watching. We have to go for our first commercial break now, so we'll be back after 2 minutes with my amazing guest this week, Liz Hoggard, who is a leading health and lifestyle journalist that writes for The Telegraph. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at. And with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Liz Hoggard, who is a leading health and lifestyle journalist for The Telegraph. So, Liz, we were talking about your amazing article about cholesterol. Let's switch it up a little bit, because I don't want to be controversial or impolite, but the list of articles that you've written is quite varied on a list of different things in and around the space, including things like alcohol, sleep, stress, a 1970s diet, dementia, hearing loss. And so how, just before we dig into some of these things, like how do you work out what to write about, particularly if you are like a gonzo type, experience it yourself sort of journalist?
Think you look at your own lifestyle, what problems are cropping up, but also you get given commissions from the desk if you're lucky. I mean,
I didn't know that.
these days, yes. And so I have to commend my brilliant health editors who sometimes have, like, the 70s diet wasn't my idea, it was hers. And I noticed they've done a couple of others. They did a brilliant 1950s one, living like a 1950s housewife, using a mangle. I didn't have to do that. So they have an idea, I guess, because of the response that newspapers get the line to pieces. So I will send a list of my thoughts for that week, or books that are coming out, or any topic we're all talking about. Everything, everyone's moaning over a bottle of wine or whatever, and they'll go, none of those really. But would you like to do something on the liver? But
Have
yes,
you?
some of them are my ideas, but really you are given quite a lot of commissions, and sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't,
Well, let's talk about one that did, the 1970s diet. So, what was that all about? That's kind of, where did that come from, and why did they choose that one? And that looked like it went very well.
Yes, I mean, I think, occasionally people have this very brilliant YouTube series where a young woman, a nutritionist, has eaten her way through the different decades. I think they've already done, perhaps, I wonder if they've, no, I think they did the 80s diet after me, but the 70s, funnily enough, I misunderstood at first because I remember 70s food is just terrible. Growing up, it was all Angel Delight and Instant Whip and Bam Fritters. So I got excited and said, oh God, yeah, it'd be great to eat all those terrible things. And she said, no, okay, sometimes the ingredients weren't perfect, but it was the way we ate. We ate a lot less. The shops shut at 6 o'clock. We couldn't do Deliveroo and takeaways. And we had a much more probably post-war diet in lots of ways. So it completely changed the way that I saw it. So then I had to get a portion control plate and a special gadget that showed me exactly what one unit of wine was, and realize how big our portion sizes have got, out of control.
So what is the difference in portion control? Like, can you kind of quantify, or what, can you explain it? Because that's really interesting.
Well, I think for alcohol, what they'd say now is a large glass of wine in a pub could be almost half a bottle. I mean, that's why you're paying more. That's why it's sometimes 12, £14 or whatever, which is a bit scary because you think, oh, I've only had one unit. In fact, you've
You've had
possibly had
six?
three, or six. And with a portion control, it's quite childlike actually, but I quite liked it. It was a plate that showed that at least half of it should be, it should be lettuce or vegetables, or and then a sort of fist size of portion of protein, and then carbs, preferably beans rather than potatoes. But it was really interesting talking to the experts. So we're really only supposed to have about a matchbox size of cheese a day. Well, I was certainly having more than that, and I learned that by grating it, I
like
can
a
get a lot
little,
more out of my matchbox.
yeah, one of those big ones or one of those little ones, you know what I mean? Because there's different sizes.
And it's interesting because when you talk to, I mean, I talk to the British Heart Foundation and, Diabetic Society, all these amazing people a lot, and they're torn between terrifying us and putting everybody off so that we bother, and being realistic about the sort of changes that we need to make. And interestingly, it's not my area of specialism, but I think there's some concern about the vegan diet because it can still be quite unhealthy, even though you're not eating, meat products or whatever. So we all need a bit more advice.
And so, like, as a factor, like, are we eating twice as much generally? And like, was the portion, was it, is that sort of roughly, it sounds like roughly twice as much per, is
Yeah, I
that kind
think
of?
one they used the example of was porridge and muesli and things like that. And most people don't really know what 30 grams is, what it looks like. It's probably only 2.5, tablespoonfuls of oats or whatever. So there's lots of things like that where we perhaps don't realize. But also, one of the things that was really interesting about 70s dieting, well, it wasn't even dieting. It just, we our parents didn't have very much money. They weren't living on credit. There wasn't so much access to food. So basically, when you'd been served a portion, the serving bowl went away and was perhaps used as leftovers for the next day. Whereas we are sort of leaving, I'll just have a bit more,
Yeah, like seconds and thirds.
Yes.
That's really interesting. That's so funny that how like these sort of societal trends have like led us down this pathway, you know, where now like even the charities are concerned because if they come out and sort of say things that are slightly too scary, people will just switch off. It's a terrible situation to be in. It's a bit of a, you know, you don't, you know, can't do right for doing wrong kind of situation.
Yeah, and I think, It's this idea of making small changes, small intelligent changes, swapping things in and out. And also, I've talked to quite a lot of consultants recently who feel that because the Mediterranean diet at the moment, the trend seems to be that that's the most healthy way of doing it. But that might be a bit culturally insensitive. If you come from a South Asian background, you're not going to be eating that stuff. So I think the idea is to work with different communities about what they can bear to change. What doesn't taste very much different and what does. And I suppose, in a way, being a guinea pig, they're always very keen on me to say, oh, I just couldn't bear that. But yeah, that was too bad. I'm prepared to keep going.
Have you done anything on ultra processed foods yet? Like doing either just UPF or not UPF, or what's the is that coming? What do you think?
I've read, obviously, all the great pieces on it, Zoe App's been very good on it, and obviously Chris's book about ultra processed foods. But I think what I'd like to look at is the tricks and how we can spot them, because so many people say to me, oh, I'm having my healthy protein bar today, and you think, oh, actually, but it's not fair to people that we've been misled by marketing, and there are lots of tricks making things smell the right way, playing with our sensory perceptions and mouth feel and all that sort of thing. And I just think if we could be a bit wiser, and I mean, obviously already brilliant experts giving us tips, but a lot of us are misled and are not making good decisions without realizing.
So yeah, this is one of my new areas of kind of interest. So my wife read the Tulikin book, Ultra Processed People. I've just started it, and his brother Zand actually came in and did a special in our lab, actually around PopDoc, which was called Dr. Zand. But this, and then over the weekend, I found a cereal box, which had a Nutri-Score on it. It was chocolate cereal, and it was Nutri-Score A. And I was like, how is that a Nutri-Score A? So then I went off down a little bit of a rabbit hole on LinkedIn and put it up. And people basically, they told me that the EU Nutri-Score thing, okay, so when it says green A, because my kids have got it and they're like, oh, it's an A, Dad, don't worry. And they'd thrown it in the trolley. And I was too busy trying to stop them wrestling on the floor or whatever I was doing. I was like, fine, we just need to get out because everyone's looking. So let's just go, please. And it turns out that this Nutri-Score thing is only within the category. So it in the category of chocolate cereals, this is the most healthy chocolate cereal, but it's a great big blazing green A on the front of the box. So I mean it's just not, I mean that type of stuff just isn't fair on people. It's just like hugely misleading.
Yes, I've got one of those food apps where you just put your camera over the barcode, and that has been fascinating. So one brand of oatcakes that looks really healthy isn't, and then yet the other one is. So, but the thing you do look like a shoplifter at the supermarket. I can only bear to do it so often, but I have found it really helpful. And it tells you the environment, can't even say it, environmental impact as well
Oh, that's
as
good.
nutritional impact. So, just those things are slightly helpful if you're having a moment of, oh, surely that won't do too much harm if I eat that.
Yeah, I think one of the things in this area that, again, we've come at this area. Have you heard of health inequality? Like this idea of health inequality, like the kind of the in certain areas, there's this huge split between in life expectancy between the wealthiest and the least wealthy in any given area. It can be up to like 10 years in the same geographical area based on whether or not it's a deprived postcode or not. And one of the things that I've not, maybe it's in the book, the ultra processed people, and we've got to it yet. But I think there's somehow we've got to be really careful that whatever the solution here is, it doesn't create a massive affordability crisis for which is, and I don't, again, I'm not an expert, so I don't know what the solution is, but those foods are significantly cheaper, I suspect, on average, than foods that don't have those in it because the food companies did it because it's cheaper. So I don't know. That's something that I've not quite got my head around yet.
No, I think that's very true. And talking to the hepatologists for the liver piece and all those
Oh.
cardio surgeons and all the cardiovascular surgeons, they are very strong on. Some people cannot afford to be healthy. It's too expensive. And I think we're just reading, aren't we, this week, that the price of fruit and vegetables are going to go up. And I guess
oh,
I
is
did.
that is it is it is it has that come out?
Yes,
I didn't see
it's
that.
going to happen. It's a big news story. I'm presuming we'll be finding features on that quite soon. But
Oh, man.
You know, I may not always agree with Jeremy Clarkson on certain things, but I think the idea that the farmers should be paying more, we should be paying more for our food. It's mad that we're not. But how does that leave people on a very modest income? And I have to say, I'm amongst those. You know, there is a moment where you think that is the right type of pasta to buy, you know, according to experts. But actually, the essential range from supermarket is much more within my price point. So I think it's a continual discussion you have.
Yeah, I didn't see that. Is it going up because of inflation or because of other pressures?
I think probably poor harvesting, you know, poor weather. You know, we've had a very wet season. You know, it's been good for the roses, but not very good for vegetables. But it will make it harder. I mean, the thing that I still feel really moved by was that Jamie Oliver Ministry of Food.
Oh, my gosh.
And passed it on. I think we should have more of that. It was so
powerful. Oh, my gosh. I mean, that was one of the most incredible. I don't know the backstory behind it. I don't know whether it was him that came up with the idea or whether it was kind of his production team or whatever. But what an incredible piece of content. Just like when he backed up the sugar truck. Do you see that? Like he backed up the what an impact. I don't know quite whether that impact's been sustained. But for a period of time, it was sort of like schools were almost being shunned for not following what he said.
Yeah, and the dinner ladies that he ended up having a row with at the end of the series before, rather than vilifying them, he went to see them to say, what do we do? Why do you feel this? What are we not helping on? And that was such a brilliant response, rather than demonising people who were just doing the best they could, really.
Yeah, it's that thing, which is, he did it well, right? But it takes a bit of, I think you've got to really think it through about how do you communicate that someone's choices are suboptimal without patronizing or without being unhelpful, but like actually helping them down a proper pathway, if that makes sense. It's really, really, really difficult because, like, again, it's all well and good telling people to eat more healthily, but you know, that they, if you don't kind of have an understanding of their personal situation, it can come across really badly.
Well, and also I work freelance now, so I am allowed to cook from scratch at home while I'm transcribing. But, you know, I worked with young colleagues who are rising up in their careers on good salaries, and I worry about them because the food they're eating is rubbish. They're basically very long hours. By the time they get home, it's all takeaways or, you know, made in dark kitchens, not even from the restaurants half the time that they think they're.
Yeah, that's another thing I didn't know about until about 12 to 18 months ago, these stealth kitchens.
So they are living on takeaways probably 2 to 3 nights of the week. You know, they don't feel like cooking when they get back. So the brightest, most brilliant young people of our generation are eating rubbish a lot of the time. And I know that the experts are worried about that. And we're seeing higher instances of cancer among young people, and which is not to say anyone through diet necessarily gets cancer, but there's definitely a sense that we've slightly lost control of what and how we eat because we're all time poor.
Well, I think it's time poor for sure. And yeah, everyone's in it's a, you know, it's been a tough economic climate for a while now, and people are working hard and trying to keep the lights on and doing all that type of thing. I think also bad foods become easier to get, and I maybe not cheaper because of inflation, but certainly like more accessible, you know, like you used to have to kind of, if I walk down a UK high street now, it's predominantly food and beverage and entertainment. You know, it's everywhere. So it's kind of like an entertainment culture, I think, or at least it's moving that direction.
Well, yeah, for my liver piece, I interviewed this brilliant nutritionist who said we have so many eating opportunities now. And Christmas is a bad example.
Yeah, it's not great. Not great timing, but yeah.
Free drinks, canapés, afternoon tea, all in one day, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but what can you do, though, about that? Like, what can you actually do? Because you can't ban restaurants and you can't ban, like, what could you? You could do a sugar tax, which did that come in a little bit, but not properly. Did it properly come in? I can't remember.
Oh, no, you've got me on that one. No,
I think they did something, because my mate worked at PepsiCo and he said that he had to do something about it. But I can't remember if it was the full hog.
OK, not like the 17th century where the coffee and the tea was taxed. Yes, and also I think, it's difficult because food is so primal. If you take away things that people enjoy, they'll rebel and they'll be stubborn. We've got to find clear ways of doing it.
You can't, prohibition doesn't, well, prohibition rarely works. Let's put it that way. I think there's been quite a lot of examples of that one being tried, and it doesn't seem to affect demand massively. But we're going to come back with the last part of the show. I want to dig into what your favorite articles have been and your most enjoyable things to go off and experience in the last part of the show. So we're going to take our final break now with Liz Hoggard, who is a leading health and lifestyle journalist from The Telegraph. We'll be right back after this break.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck. Fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's show with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Liz Hoggard, who is a leading health and lifestyle journalist for The Telegraph. So, Liz, why don't you start walking us through some of your favourite articles that you wrote and why they were your favourites?
Well, it's funny because it's not always punitive. It's not always you have to give this up and never drink again and never eat cheese. I did do a very funny one at the end of last year. It was based on the fact that there's a generation of older people who are what they call perma drinkers. It's the sort of the boomers. So it was like my week of drinking like a boomer, partly because they're retired and they don't have to go to work. But it was inspired by Lord Lawson, Nigel Lawson, who had a rather fantastic hedonistic time at the end of his life. I mean, he sort of, even on his deathbed, he was having a couple of glasses of red wine and an Armagnac and an extra goose or something, as you'd hope, and died blameless in his bed. I mean, that doesn't happen to everyone, obviously. But no. So I had to do this for a week, and I had to go around with rackety people and have boozy lunches and then see what he was doing to me. And that was a bit shocking, really,
What did you feel like at the end of the week? I mean, how many units a day do you reckon you were doing?
I think I was definitely doing at least 8 to 10. And I had to do it from the beginning because I think it's Fergus Henderson, the brilliant chef. He has this cool thing. Oh, God, what's something Branca?
It's Fernie Branca. I remember. Do they? Is it all chefs?
I think a lot of them do. A little nip to. And I think, to be fair, he had, because he has Parkinson's, he'd been told by his sort of doctors that if anything that boosted him, it would help in the mornings to be a bit more mobile. But I had to drink this first thing at like 10 o'clock in the morning as vile. And so by the end, and I had to make sure I came home for a digestive and various things in the evening. And I've been an enthusiastic drinker, but I was just like, no more, take it away. How do they do it?
So, but what were your kind of, what were the conclusions that you drew at the end of it? What were the
Well,
kind
I
of.
did meet some, although there's a brilliant woman who used to be the restaurant critic of Harper's, Jennifer Sharp, and she taught me some tricks, which is, you probably only have one glass and let the sort of sommelier take the bottle away, or you check the alcoholic proof of it, so that you have more control. So if you're going to have fun, you do, but you don't get into that habit of yet another bottle or whatever. So though, and drinking water and eat. The big one that everyone says is just eat at the same time as drinking. It's so damaging to your kidneys and your liver if you drink on an empty stomach, basically.
Is that right? It actually has more than, because I thought it was just, I didn't realize it was more damaging to your kidneys and liver.
Yeah, it's much worse. And it because the liver doesn't have a chance to process it. I mean, that was the other thing that I learned actually from the Boomer piece, that if you for every unit of alcohol you drink, you basically it takes your liver an hour to it's a brilliant creature, brilliant creature. It will do everything it can to help you, but that's all it's going to be doing for that hour, and you have to allow that in. Plus, it's why we have slightly broken sleep if we've had a night out drinking. The poor liver can't do anything else. It can't do anything else to help your body because it's so busy getting rid of the alcohol out of your body. And I did another piece where we looked at what is the consequences of a Christmas hangover and how shamingly it can go on for days, particularly as you get older because your ability to process alcohol decreases. But then I did do a brilliant one, which was about having an AI robot physio in a to stop all these terrible backlogs for people who've got back and musculoskeletal pain. So that was fun. I got a real crush on my robot. So,
Oh, you actually got a real robot.
well, she's not a robot. She's a real person. I met her in the end. Very nice woman called Kirsty, who is a proper physio. But it was a brilliant team who had come up with the idea. A, people are having too much back surgery and we shouldn't be having, but also, even if you retrain, they told me, even if you retrained half the country's physios, we wouldn't keep up with the backlog of people who've either got back problems or musculoskeletal problems.
Yeah, it's the second, it's the biggest cause of work absence, I think. It's
Yes.
MSK.
And depression, and your whole life starts to, and unless you're in extraordinary pain, in which case you would be siphoned out of the group and dealt with separately. The thing is, we have to keep moving when we're in discomfort, and it's much better for us if we do. If we stop moving altogether, then it just gets worse, and our psychological state changes. So what they did was they have videoed her and made little films of her doing every single physio. It's basically medical grade Pilates and yoga, and then according to your symptoms, as your profile builds up on the app, you get sent special exercises. So you feel like she's in the room with you on your phone, but actually it's recorded. And you feel like you've disappointed her if you don't do your exercises. There's quite a lot of clever psychology there.
Yeah, like it keeps you kind of hooked in. That's really interesting. I think the because obviously we work with a lot of NHS stuff, and MSK is right up there with in terms of like workplace absence, in terms of backlog, in terms of cost, in terms of workforce problems because there aren't enough physios. It's a massive issue. It's an absolutely huge issue.
Well, this company Flock, and I'm sure there are other ones coming up alongside, are that the plan is to roll it out on the NHS. So you would get it for free. I mean, obviously your local authority or your GP practice would in some ways be subsidising it, but you could go on it straight away rather than being in a long queue. And also they're explaining to me that if you have an injury over the weeks, it can change what you need to do for it. And if you just go away with a sort of photocopied series of exercises 2 months down the line, it's probably not much use.
So I know the one firm I know that's doing really well in the NHS doing exactly this is called Get You Better. So they've been around for quite a while and does a similar type of approach. And apparently it's really successful. I've not used it, but yeah, I mean the days of, well, if ever a photocopied sheet of exercises ever worked, they are long gone, I believe. But
I think
like,
another problem is something that is tech poverty, because we've got this generation who, like my mum was a teacher, so they weren't even allowed to have mobile phones in the classroom. So really she skipped the generation of knowing about phones and even laptops and computers. And I think it's brilliant that we can now go on the NHS app and do repeat prescriptions, book our vaccines, all the rest of it. But they're going to get left behind. I mean, I've had to really try very hard. Apps are not my natural thing. You know, part of the sight thing, if you've got difficult sight. But we're going to need to work much more kindly with people and just not expecting them to deal with it straight away.
It's also stuff like, you know, you can't use the app unless you have an internet connection. Well, why are we assuming that everyone has Wi-Fi? Not just there's rurality to it, but there's also a cost to it. You know, there's just it all plays into this area of health inequality, and trying to make sure that we're trying to narrow the gap as opposed to doing things to widen the gap. You know, it's a big topic that whenever we interact with NHS institutions, that's something that gets debated extensively, is how can digital technology actually close health inequality as opposed to just making it worse. It's a major issue.
And then, I mean, you know, I do think you can do things like psychotherapy online, on Zoom, you know, with your therapist. I think it probably helps if you've met them already and you have some sort of relationship. But I was hearing some worrying stuff about how quite a lot of therapists of different types, nutritional therapists, psychotherapists, are finding that they haven't got as much work because AI is taking the place of it. People are just typing in and feeling that they can get this for free. And the trouble
what?
Is
what? Psychotherapy?
Very, you know, it is something, there's a privacy element to it apart from anything else.
Wow. Yeah. I've not heard of people sort of opting out of actual face-to-face therapy to talk to an AI. That's slightly terrifying.
Yes, I mean, I think with the nutritional therapy, it's more that you know, I can come up with a plan for them.
Oh, okay.
It filters all the articles that we all write, you know. So, I mean, it's very helpful if people are trying to educate themselves. But as we know, one week it says gin is the best drink, and then the next week it says the only thing you must avoid is gin. So,
well, interestingly, when you were doing your cholesterol thing, did you come across something called plant sterols?
No, what's that?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a debate about them. So there's really strong clinical evidence that plant sterols, sterol is a chemical compound, they lower cholesterol. They can be, but they're found naturally in certain foods, which I can't remember right now for the life of me, but they're found in certain foods. So if you look on Heart UK's website, I'm sure British Heart Foundation's got them. There's like a section, but there's companies that have now made sterol supplements, so you can buy the same compound technically as a supplement, but there's no clinical evidence about their efficacy. And it's just an interesting debate because plant sterols very definitely lower cholesterol, like clearly when they're contained within a plant, but there's no clinical evidence about these sterols. And so it's sort of this slightly gray area where like the sterol supplement people are pointing at the data around the plant sterols, which is legitimate. I'm just curious if it came up in the NHS doesn't mention them on their website or anything on the content. It just says plant sterols good. It doesn't mention anything about supplements.
Oh, I'll have to add that to my list. I mean, I know, I think all of us are a bit wary of those with added protein because you think just eat them. And certainly, you know, I take a supplement as one that I think is rather good, but actually, really, you should be getting most of those vitamins from your actual real food, you know. And certainly when I did the liver piece, everybody said liver supplements, you know, including milk thistle, there's absolutely no evidence that it does.
Oh, is there none whatsoever?
But then there was a really, you know, there's always a brilliant payoff that you get from these pieces. So coffee, drinking three cups of coffee is likely to help your liver. And that's the one thing that consultants tend to recommend to patients with liver damage. So, you know, there's a win.
How does coffee help your liver? That's amazing.
There's something in the coffee that helps sort of digest and offset some of the sort of the fatty acids or whatever. So, and again, it turned up in the cholesterol piece. But what I had to learn to do with cholesterol was not to drink the filtered coffee where the grounds go into the cup.
Uh-huh.
I have to use that little filtering thing, the old fashioned with a piece of filter paper.
Oh, so the drip coffee.
Yeah, that's fine. Otherwise, you can definitely raise your cholesterol. A lot of people think by... I had no idea. So those things are useful.
But you say it's interesting because last year when I did this experiment on myself, slightly similar to your experiment, I quit caffeine and alcohol. And I drink the coffees where you end up like an espresso type thing. And I think it had an impact based on, you know, my own personal experience. So it's interesting that you say that. So in the last 5 minutes of the show, I'd love to cover off one specific thing, which is your article, which was around how to handle stress like a man. So what was that? Why did you write that?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I think that was dreamed up by the women on the desk at
Okay.
Health. They were sort of looking at their husbands and partners and thinking they have no idea. And
Yeah.
actually, what and it's funny because I went to a lot of experts. Some were, particularly women, were a bit wary of the topic
Okay.
because, no feminist wants to say we should all be more like men. We're very happy with being women, thank you. But there are tactics that men use, probably unconsciously, that we could
Yeah.
learn from,
Like
which is
what?
not, not to sweat the small stuff, not to take everything to heart,
Okay.
to prioritize exercise. I thought that was a very interesting one. They were saying in families, it's usually the woman that goes, "Oh, do you know what? I haven't got time to go to yoga tonight."
Right.
Whereas the man, it will probably be set in stone as sort of sacred.
Okay.
And so there were some really useful tips. I mean, I'm sure it annoyed the male readers as it was supposed to, but it was a fairly fair piece. It was like, guys, you're doing some good stuff. We need to do it too,
Oh, yeah, I think the other, yeah, I mean, one of the things that gets debated with me and my wife, which I think is completely legitimate, is the mental load. I mean, the mental load that she carries around administration and things of the family is incredible. And so I don't know. I'm not seeing too many articles around the mental load. But it'd be cool if there was one written. Have you covered it or not yet?
I think they have a bit, the Americans tend to call it emotional labor, and women do more
Ah.
of emotional labor. And really, things like that are like Christmas cards don't matter. And perhaps you don't have to send a thank you note every time. And perhaps, I mean, I think women are more sensitive beings and they, more collegiate and they spot things. And it's very important that we have that quality. But there are certain things, it's like let the monkeys off your back or whatever, that in terms of prioritizing, some things simply don't matter. And you'll go mad if you try and do them.
Okay, that makes sense. So the final couple of minutes of the show, what have been your takeaways throughout your career that you continue to kind of come back to, that you feel like either it's mottos or phrases, or just how have you kind of kept going and kept writing every week, 2 weeks, getting these articles out, kept being motivated about it? Have you got any advice for anyone listening who might be in a similar situation?
I think just be nosy, be really nosy and curious and listen to what your friends are saying. Sometimes that's your best control group. If two people have said to you that week, "I'm really fed up with X," or "I've watched that television program," then take note.
That's a great piece of advice. On that note, Liz, we've come to the end of the show.
Oh,
Thank you
thank you
so
very much.
much. Thank you so much for coming on. That was super interesting. And I just, thank you very much for coming on, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
No worries. We'll be back again next week with a new show.